Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. Glad you could join me. Yeah, taking another trip back to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, where we will talk with a pro guide and a land access expert. Yeah, Trevor Waltz and Tom Dabrowski join me from landtrust.com. We're going to talk about scouting, hunting strategies, tactics, even some dog care and training advice from guys who know their stuff inside and out. We'll also, in our Handle It segment, praise dead birds. You'll get it when I talk about it. And your Facebook posts in particular on how important a limit is to you. Why and why not? Yeah, been pondering that question a lot lately. It's all made possible by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, Pointer Shotguns, Mid-Valley Clays and Shooting School, TruLock Choke Tubes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, LandTrust.com, ESPAmerica.com, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. Well, around here, it's, you know, the wishing and hoping season. On top of all the training and the shooting practice, trying to get it together for next season. Planning my, you know, big trip. Get out of the snow, hunt 3 days, travel one, hunt 3 days, write a magazine article, you know. But stretch that thing out, and the goal being, don't hunt on snow-covered ground. I'm looking for suggestions in the West. Make a big loop out of the whole thing. So if you got any ideas, don't hesitate to contact me. I sure appreciate it. Maybe you're doing the same thing. You're also pondering how important a limit is to you. And I thought that was worth discussing a little bit more. The upshot, most people couldn't care less about a whole tailgate full of birds. And I understand that completely. Someday in a seminar, I'll go through that and the rationale behind it, and maybe even a little bit of psychology. But I thought it was fascinating what you said about this topic. Bryce Cousins says, plenty of days hunting, I don't reach my limit. The dogs and hunting companions are what makes a good day a field. Isn't that the truth, Bryce? Robert Murphy says, growing up, it was important because we relied on wild game as a food source. Now, it means nothing. It's all about spending time with my dog and watching them hunt. You guys detecting a pattern already? James Inbody says, limit isn't very important at all. Dog work and being in the outdoors, more important in my older age. You know, that's the problem. Old age is wasted on old people. No, not really. It's not wasted at all. Olson's Gun Dog says, it's not very important at all in it for the dog work. Dog work, dog work, dog work. Yeah, yeah, and yeah. Lance Larson says he outgrew the limit thing back in his 30s. So, yeah, good for you, Lance. And but once in a while, it is good to shoot something, especially when you're guiding Bob Knight. That was such a fun time. When you got into dogs, Lance, it was important. Yeah, we evolve, don't we? Isn't that what it's about? You know, you start wanting to hit anything. Then you start wanting to hit a lot of things. Then hitting anything isn't important anymore. Yeah, like Michael Gugino says, not important anymore. Still want to shoot well when the opportunity presents itself. But if it doesn't, I'm still a happy guy. Oh, and Michael adds to his dog work pleasure, I get a big kick out of watching my son shoot. You do much of that? I do. I've even done it on the show a few times. You know, just put the gun down, guide for somebody else. It's a project I'm working on. I'll share more with you if it ever turns into anything. But the idea of limiting your kill by guiding somebody else, you still get all the thrill of somebody shooting and also the dog work thing and also the companionship thing. Make any sense? It does for most people. Bill Dickerson says, as I near age 80, a limit of birds used to be the goal, but now I truly enjoy watching my two cockers work. Yeah, I bet you do. We on public land get an occasional bird, makes the three of us happy. Keith Anderson says, now it's the fellowship and a dog work as well. So, he's already living the plan I just outlined. If my dog points a bird for a hunter's first bird and he shoots it and the dog brings it to him, especially if it's a youth, well, that can make the whole season. Yeah, lots of great thought-provoking answers in there, all very encouraging and wonderful, wonderful way to look at hunting. Way different than we used to, I think. So thanks for your participation. It got me to thinking, and I appreciate that. I need all the help I can get in that department. We're brought to you in part here at the Upland Nation podcast by Purina Pro Plan Sport Dog Food. Learn more about all their formulations and the nutrition science behind it at ProPlanSport.com. I've mentioned it before, but it's absolutely true. I get to hang with some of the experts in their field when I'm in the ProPlan booth at Pheasant Fest. And boy, I'll tell you, you learn something every day. Not just about dog nutrition, but about performance, some of the supplements. I've learned another way to use their Fortiflora probiotic. All of their products are carefully researched, tested, and quality controlled. Yeah, check the bag, go to the website, learn more about what they do at Purina Pro Plan Sport for you and your dogs. ProPlanSport.com. And I also got to spend considerable time in the Pointer Shotguns booth at Pheasant Fest and learned again. Thank you, guys, for kind of re-educating me on some of the stuff that I, you know, kind of sort of knew but didn't know well enough. I was amazed at how many people were just drawn, laser-like, drawn to that 28-gauge over and under with a case-colored receiver. Beautiful gun, easy to shoulder, swings nice and smooth, and the fit and finish, amazing for the affordable price. Learn more about all the choices at pointershotguns.com. Whether you need a youth gun, Tom, you listening, or you're looking for an upgrade for your own shooting situation, whether you're going from pump to over and under to side-by-side, semi-auto, etc., they're all there at pointershotguns.com. Well, welcome back to the floor of the, what would I call it? The biggest meeting of crazy bird hunters in the entire universe. We're at the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota this year. And boy, oh boy, what a crowd. We're here. This is a Saturday morning podcast recording. And the aisles are already too crowded. But I luckily found two people who were willing to come out of their booth and talk with me from LandTrust.com, and you know them because I'm talking about them all the time. I have Tom Dombrowski and Trevor Waltz. Now, guys, first off, how's the show been for each of you?
It's been great. You know, it's the first time we've been here as a brand. I've heard a lot of good things over the years. You know, worked with Shields for a lot of years in my prior career, and you know they always talked really highly of it. We're certainly big supporters of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, so yeah, we're happy to be here and having a lot of great conversations.
Tom, you're over your booth, guys, is over where I suggested, and close to where all the conservation land improvement and landowner services are. How's that been? Has that worked out for you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've enjoyed the interaction with the other folks in the other booths, and we bounce around, and when it slows down a little bit, and have nice conversations, kind of compare notes and so forth. Yeah. It's been awesome.
Oh, that's great. Now, Trevor, why don't you start off the conversation? Explain again in a capsule what LandTrust.com is.
Sure. We're a marketplace. We think one of the easier ways to describe it is we're very similar to an Airbnb, but we're focused on private land access for recreation. So we partner with landowners, predominantly multi-generation farmers and ranchers, so people producing our food, fuel, and fiber every day. They list their land. We don't own any land. We don't lease any land. We don't contract anything. So a landowner comes to us, they list their land, and we bring in people like you and I that want to go hunting, fishing, camping, shed hunting, anything outdoors. Mm-hmm. And we kind of bring those two groups together and let them create great experiences.
Tom, your title is Landowner Success Manager, and I think I know a little bit about how that works, and you're doing a great job, by the way. But, you know, explain, take us to the next step with that. It's DIY, so we're not going to show up and expect a guide or an outfitter. It's for us who are basically self-contained. But why don't you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, well, first of all, what we try and do with the landowners is when we have boots on the ground like myself in Kansas, I will travel throughout the state and meet with different landowners. I will photograph their property. I will, when it's appropriate, put trail cameras up on their property. We'll set waypoints that indicate exits, entrances, gates, whatever if there's tree stands for deer hunting, if there's feeders, if there's whatever you may have on your property, we'll notate that on Onyx Maps so that the sportsman can find their spots very easily. We create that as a big benefit to those guys, because it is do-it-yourself, and they are sometimes do-it-yourself on 2,500 acres needs a little bit of help.
So unless it's me, then it needs a lot of help.
Yeah. But that's what we try and do, is try and shorten it, the learning curve on that specific property a little bit for them.
Well, and we appreciate it, and shortening is a good word to dwell on for a moment, because the key to this is we're not committed to a season or a month or
that's
a week.
Right.
We can waltz in for one day and access that land. And,
absolutely.
And that's the most exciting part to a guy like me. I'm ADD or something, so I like to move around a lot. And this creates an opportunity for that.
Yeah, you can hunt multiple properties in a weekend.
Yeah. You know, we're here at Pheasant Fest and the Quail Classic, and we're talking about landtrust.com, and you have a booth, and everything seems to be going well. But we're really here to talk about bird hunting. And again, Trevor, you've been a pro guide. And you've got
I don't know if I'm a pro. Well, I mean, that's always up for discussion.
You hunt more than me. You maybe hunt more than Tom. I don't know about that yet. But how was your season?
It was great. I mean, I'm a little biased. I think every season's great.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about this before, Scott. I mean, it's about being out there. It's about the dogs. It's about creating great experiences. Every year you deal with stuff that you can't control, and you know, it's, you learn from that, and you look back on it and you're excited for the next one. So no, it was a great year. Lots of time in Montana, got to Idaho a little bit, got to Wyoming a little bit, spent some really nice time in Arizona. So yeah, it's not complaining about anything.
No, and we'll talk more about Arizona because I'm selfish and I hope to be there, but I do want to talk, you talked about things don't always go exactly the way you want them to go. And when I saw you last in person, we were ministering to a dog that had, we think, eaten a bee.
Maybe more than one bee.
Oh, yeah, my God. I only bring that up not to dwell on it for that reason, but because you were so calm, cool, and collected, and you basically did what we all think we should do, but you did it and it worked. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, Benadryl's the ticket there. And Benadryl, hydration, and just keeping the dog calm.
Yeah.
And he, you know, we were in a good situation where there wasn't a lot of distraction, happening in the environment. And, you know, every dog's going to handle that situation differently as well. But he was calm, which helped. And so, yeah, a little bit of Benadryl. Put him up in his box for a while to sleep it off, and he was ready to go again. But yeah, I mean, in all seriousness, you know, even a bee you need to take seriously, and Benadryl is something you should have with you at all times.
You know, and this is, everybody agrees, we all got it, but what form and how do you administer it?
10 milligrams per 10 pounds a dog. And, you know, whether that's in a pill form or liquid, you know, depending on your partnership with your vet, or maybe you are a vet, there is an injectable version of it as well. But for most of us, you know, what you buy over the counter is, and I would also, you know, stress, you know, I'm not a vet. You know, that's a conversation you should have with your vet.
Yes.
And, you know, depending on the dog, some dogs, a vet may say, cut that dose in half.
Yeah.
You know, they may say, give them a little more. So I would encourage, you know, have it, know your dogs, have the conversation with your vet, and then, you know, understand how and when to administer.
You know, the other thing I would only add to that would be have your vet's number on speed dial.
And
in most of the country now, you can call in a panic, mm-hmm. and they can walk you through some of that stuff.
Yeah, and I would know your environment there too. I try my best to, before I leave service, to figure out, you know, what is the closest vet, and have that number on hand. You know, and sometimes that's you know, a situation that, you know, at the least expected time.
Yeah.
And you want to just have that information.
Well, that's what they call it, an emergency.
Exactly.
Tom, how about yourself? How was your bird season?
I was fantastic. You know, I live in Kansas, and so most of my hunting was done in the state of Kansas. As everybody who has hunted in Kansas in the last few years knows, we're in a bit of a drought.
Yeah.
Our bird numbers are not what they always have been. But as Trevor alluded to earlier, it's all about the dogs for me. At my age, I get more from watching them do their thing than I do anything else.
What kind of dogs do you have?
I've got a 2-year-old GSP, and I've got an 8-year-old English Pointer.
Oh, my.
And he's getting a little tired. He had a cancer and a mast cell tumor removed from his rear leg last year, and it slowed him down quite a bit. But he's still, you know, his head is in it all the time. You let him out of the truck, and he's all business. So, and doesn't cover quite as much ground as he once did, but I tell you what, he doesn't waste any time out there.
Yeah.
He really gets after it, and it's fun to watch him.
The youngster,
if I put them both on the ground, he acquiesces a bit to the youngster.
Really?
And lets the youngster, now that he's two, he lets him kind of lead the way a little bit, and it's fun watching the both of them and how they interact. And when the youngster needs to back off a little bit, the old boy, you know, he makes it clear to him. So their interaction is pretty fun.
I love it. I always remember that when I had two wire hairs at the same time, the old guy he'd watch the bird fall, he'd go over to it, and then he'd see the young guy coming at him. He'd say, okay, you can have that. I'm going to go find another live bird. The dynamics are always different, but always fun.
Yes.
What was a highlight of your season?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I would say we were hunting a little hillside, and my 2-year-old went on point, and I had the 8-year-old in the truck and in the kennel, and Covey busted, and I was able to put two birds on the ground, and I wasn't expecting quail. I had 3-inch sixes in, so I wasn't expecting quail, but when I hit them both, I knew that they both went down dead. The youngster could only find one bird, and I knew they were dead, and we looked and looked and looked. I ended up going out to the road, and the whole time, that 400-yard walk to the road, I knew that old boy of mine would find that bird, and I told the other guys, we're going back because I know it's there, and we took him back out there, and within a minute out of the truck, he found that bird, dug it out of the deep grass. It was dead.
I love it.
Yeah, that was probably the highlight for me.
Oh, man, I had one that was slightly different, but the same feeling at the end. We shot a chucker that went off the cliff and down into this deep, dark valley. And we wouldn't send a dog over the cliff, but on the way back, it ended up we had to walk through that deep, dark valley, which fortunately had a really bad dirt road. Son of a gun, if we're not 100 yards from the dogs, and the dogs are all kind of just congregated in the middle of that really bad road, my dog, Flick, brings back the chucker that had landed right there. Talk about luck. Trevor, you went to Arizona, and I need a debrief. because that's where I'm headed next season. What was the most fun you had in Arizona?
I got to say the most fun is just exploring new ground. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of it. It's a wild place. And there's a lot of similarities to home, to Montana, mm-hmm. but, yeah. you know, it's still a new place. It's tough on dogs. It's tough on us. The fun part's the learning and the exploring.
Yeah.
The bonuses are, finding what you're after, which are, I hunt all types of, whether it's desert or more mountain birds down there, but I really enjoy Mearns hunting. I had some great experiences on that. The highlight probably be, first bird for a young dog with a Mearns find. And, there's just lots of good stuff. But, the exploring and, 60 degrees in January is not all that bad either.
Yeah, 50 would be better, but I'll take 60, you bet. Did you experience like the classic Mearns find where the birds actually cooperated and held for you a little bit? How did that work?
We did, yeah. We worked harder this year for them, but I had more dogs with me this time, which was also, really nice. Mm-hmm. We had some great finds and even some really cooperative birds on young dogs, which was helpful. So, got a little bit of everything, but generally speaking, we found cooperative birds.
Nice. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast from the floor of the National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. With me today, Trevor Waltz and Tom Dombrowski from LandTrust.com. Yeah, these guys are looking for land for you to hunt. Unless they get there first. you're both in positions where people probably come up to you and say, oh, that, what a great job. All you do is walk around with a shotgun in your hands all day. Well, it ain't that, but it's better than most of us, isn't it, Tom?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes when I look at a property, I'm like, everybody's going to have to beat me there first.
You're punching into the phone, making a reservation before you leave.
I'm their first client, and I'll tell them right off the bat, hey, don't let anybody else book this until I get you. But it's fun.
Well, as a Kansan, and I love hunting Kansas. I've been all over from Goodland to Osborne to even Topeka. Where do you like to go? Don't give me the long or you'll have to kill me later. But what part of that state trips your trigger?
Well, 24 years ago, I bought a house with a couple of buddies in DeMar, Kansas. It's a little town of 100 people about 45 minutes north of Hayes. And we've been hunting that area. We've met a lot of landowners by virtue of the fact that we had little kids when we'd go out there. And those little kids met the little kids in the neighborhood in this little town of 100 people. Yeah. And sure enough, the parents would come over and say, hey, are my kids over here? But you have to meet the parents. And the parents were landowners, and we got permission to hunt that stuff. So I've been doing that for about 24 years out in that area, and it's just been a gas.
That's ringneck country, or is that quail country?
Well, we pursue quail a lot more than we do ringnecks, and if obviously a ringneck is a bonus, absolutely, and we're never going to not shoot at one when a dog points it or whatever, but our focus is more on quail.
Yeah.
And our numbers have been off in that area, just like they have been throughout the state, But we're very careful about the covey sizes that we see. And, if we've got a covey 8 birds, we're not taking any birds out of that covey. And we're not pursuing singles on a covey that might be even 16 birds. If we shoot a couple out of the bus, we're leaving them alone.
Well, that is fascinating. We all talk a good game, but we never get down to specifics like that. And it's hard to decide, especially if you had a really bad day. It's hard not to chase those broken up coveys, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there's another part of that, too, and it's about the time of day that you're hunting. Because as youngsters, we used to push at the sunset all the time.
Yeah.
And now, when we're looking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and the temperatures are starting to drop pretty significantly, we're not pursuing quail coveys, because the last thing we want to do is bust a covey up and have them not be able to get back together before that cold temperature starts to really close in on them. So we're putting a lot more thought into it as we've gotten a little bit older, and being very careful to help preserve what is out there when the numbers total numbers of birds are a little bit off.
Yeah, you met Kelly Reyna before we went on the air here, but Kelly's talking to me a lot about especially valley quail. And I have a laboratory in my backyard. I don't have any Labradors. For the record, I've never owned a Labrador. But we have water, and it's the only water for 30 miles. So we get those valley quail coming in every day. And we can study when they go to roost. And you mentioned temperature. It's temperature, and it's where the sun is and the time of year and all those other things. Can you draw any conclusions from when we should stop? Is it all of that, some of that, or should we just be cautious?
I think we'd be cautious, and I think you take all of that into consideration. If it's a day that's 50 degrees and it's warm, you might be able to hunt a little bit longer. Yeah. That night's not going to get that desperately cold for those birds. Yeah. So if you do bust them a little later in the day, it's not likely that they'll have any trouble coveying back up and surviving a semi-cold night. But if you're hunting in temperatures that are down around, 30 degrees, 35 degrees, even 40 degrees, I think you need to be very cautious about busting coveys late in the day.
Yeah, and late in the day is a relative term.
Yeah, it is. I think, I think 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, and if you're a sunset in the Midwest at 5 o'clock to 5:30, you need to be very cautious about that.
Yeah. So, the other thing, and I've talked to a few folks about the other end of the day, and Trevor, maybe you've had some observations in this area with the quail that you've hunted. I had literally the guy who wrote the book on California quail said, they're, as soon as daylight, as soon as they can see, they're dropping out of the roost. Now, California quail roost in bushes and trees. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Bob White's, and I don't know about those Arizona quail well enough. Trevor, you ever seen anything at the top end of the day that would help us hunt birds a little bit more effectively?
There's a lot of similarities there and a lot of the species we pursue. There's times of the year where you want to be out earlier than, and a lot of that for me has always been temperature and dog related, but I'm kind of sit in the camp of not getting on them right away, letting them have their breakfast and, continuing through a healthy life. I guess, being out early has its advantages for getting to your spot. And, we can help with that by, you can book an exclusive spot with us and you don't have to rush out as quick. But no, I would say, getting out in the morning is important for a lot of reasons, and I don't know that I have exacts. It's more about being out, being present, and I like to give them a little time in the morning, and then let the games begin.
I think if you get out too early, a lot of times they're still feeding.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, and that's the argument right there.
Yeah, you're right. With Bob White's, it may be that they're only 20 yards into the edge, from their cover feeding. But if you're not walking out in that 20 yards, if you're just walking cover, you may walk right past a covey.
Exactly.
That's not feeding. And pheasants are the same way. I think so many times in my younger life, I was probably out before the birds were back from the feed fields into the cover. And we learned from having to push through feed row crop to get to our cover a couple times that we were pushing birds right as the sun was coming up.
Yeah.
We're pushing birds out of the food into the cover, and we understood that, hey, that's a good thing that they're already out in the cover and we're walking through the feed and we're walking through the feed to then hunt them in the cover.
Yep. Hey, we're from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, with the National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. Scott Linden here, hosting Tom Dombrowski and Trevor Waltz of LandTrust.com. Take a look at that website, by the way. I got a couple things I want to say commercially, and then we'll be back with more from Pheasant Fest.
Well, we have more from Pheasant Fest and Trevor and Tom, so stick around for hunting advice and some other useful land access tips, all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast. Our Handle It segment why you should start collecting dead birds. I'll give you the details and a few practical tips as well coming up right after this from MidwayUSA.com. They carry just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors. Yep, still laying in my target ammo supply for this summer. I'm really going to work hard at that. But did I tell you, I also bought myself a target thrower there. One of those nice Champion, very portable, but remote controlled, so you can shoot by yourself if you need to, anytime, anywhere. Learn more about all of the great shooting supplies you can take advantage of at MidwayUSA.com. And if you're an angler, hey, I just ordered 4 dozen new flies. Check it all out at MidwayUSA.com. And had a great talk with Scott Trulock at TrulockChokes.com recently. You'll hear that in an upcoming podcast. If you're a turkey hunter and you're going to be using that new tungsten super shot, well, they've got a choke just for you. If you're a target shooter, and who isn't this time of year, take a look at their target chokes. Remember, if you want to shoot better, the simplest way to do that is to shoot a better pattern. And a better pattern comes from, well, good ammo and good choke tubes. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons that choke tubes that come in your shotgun from the factory may not be just right for you. We'll talk more about that, like I said, in an upcoming podcast. Don't forget, at TrulockChokes.com, there's a lifetime warranty, a satisfaction guarantee, and plenty of incentives to save you some money. Visit TrulockChokes.com. Welcome back to Pheasant Fest and the Quail Classic from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. From LandTrust.com, we have Tom Dombrowski and Trevor Waltz. Not only are they part of the organization in helping you find basically DIY, I'll call it enabled freelance hunting. You used Airbnb as an analogy, Trevor. You know, it's a day lease to a degree.
Yeah, and trespass fee.
All of the above. And it works. Take my word for it. In fact, when we were out there last time, I thought about extending that visit. But instead, I'll take one next fall. Early fall.
There you go.
We've been talking a little bit of everything about hunting and that sort of thing. But we haven't talked a lot about the big birds out there. Trevor, when we were out there, we were hopefully looking for sharptails together. We ended up finding a lot of Huns instead, and that's been the story of my hunting life for about 2 or 3 seasons. Huns in all the in fact, I just wrote that story for Gun Dog Magazine. Huns in all the wrong places. Have you had more of those kind of revelations, whether it's pheasants in the cattails or odd stuff lately?
No, I would say, you know, after that hunt scout, it was a little more what I'd call traditional. Yeah. You know, they're a little more where I expected them to be. And, you know, as we talked through and, you know, experienced on that property, I mean, the predators play a huge role. You know, we saw a lot of coyotes that day, and, you know, that's certainly impacting where birds are, if they're even there in general. But the rest of the season was a little more, I hate to say textbook, but, you know, more predictable. But it was an incredible hunt year. It was a great sharp tail year. We'll see, you know, what the rain brings, what the winter brings, what spring has in store for us, and we'll do it all again next year.
This textbook reference, just don't rub it in anymore, because some of us didn't have that, but we still had fun. You know, you mentioned sharptails, and I want to get back to that, because it seems, especially here in South Dakota, but it seems like every third person I talk to wants to know more about how to hunt sharp-tailed grouse. Mm. If you were to suggest a couple, 3 rules to live by, what would they be?
Buy good boots.
Yeah.
Yeah, bring a lot of water.
Yeah.
and be patient. All those things, yeah, I mean, yeah, we laugh about them, but there's some realness there. I mean, you got to be willing to put time into your boots, especially in some of the bigger properties and in bigger landscapes, because the birds they're out there, but you might have to walk a while to find them.
Yeah.
The water thing, you know, from my experience, those earlier days in the season tend to be a little more productive, but they're usually warmer. So, you know, you need water for your dogs and you need water for yourself. So, I mean, there's a lot of days where I'm carrying 8-10 bottles of water, even to be out for a couple hours with two dogs. The being patient part, especially with dogs that haven't spent a lot of time on sharptail, I mean, like any species, it's going to take them a while to figure it out.
Yeah.
And some dogs pick it up quicker than others, but I would say, you know, put all those things together and be willing to learn.
Yep. Yeah, I had somebody waylay me yesterday in the aisle, and out of the whole discussion, I basically said, walk another mile.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in general,
great advice.
Sharptailer, it's a good, you know, tight holding bird for, you know, cubby bird for a lot of dogs, and they tend to be, you know, they're not the fastest flying, so they can still be very sporting, but you know, in general, it can be a great training experience and, you know, a really fun day. But it's like any other, you know, any new pursuit or any different species, brings some challenges.
Tom, you're from Kansas, but yes, do you ever hunt sharpies?
Yes, I have, and my experience with sharpies has been, if I can get out earlier in the season, my odds seem to be a lot greater early in the season than they are later when they're starting to group up in bigger groups.
Yeah.
More, they get very nervous in the bigger groups, they seem to me.
They got more lookouts.
Yeah, they do. They do. And so, you know, they're hearing you coming and they're seeing you coming and they're not going to wait around or they're less likely to wait around as they would have been earlier in the season. So I like to get after them earlier.
You know, I tell everybody that if you want to have the best chance of finding a sharp-tailed grouse, look for the high spot and circle around it. Work your way up to it. And maybe be even a little bit more stealthy than that if you can. If there's any cover, and there never is, use it, because there's somebody up there looking at you probably. Anything like that, kind of other generalities that most sharptail hunters could use to their advantage?
And I would ask Trevor to answer that question.
Yeah, he's from Montana. He's seen a few more than both of us.
No, I think your point's accurate, Scott. I mean, they're trying to live just like any other wild bird. So yeah, they're looking out for us for sure. You know, time of day is going to affect where they are and you know how alert they are. To Tom's point, you know, as the season goes on, they group up and they got a lot more eyes. But I'd try and be under the radar. Let your dogs do what they're out there to do. And just pay attention to elements and you know, to some properties they're going to react, and some groups of birds are going to react differently, as we've experienced you know, with other species as well. You know, if they've been pressured, they're going to respond a little bit differently than the ones who haven't seen people before.
Yep. Tom, you live and breathe bobwhites out there. If you were hunting bobwhites for the first time, and you were to know, if I was hunting bobwhites for the first time and you were advising me on how to do it better, first off, yes, I'll take another shooting lesson. But second off, what are some of the, you know, for the folks, for example, here in the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, there's a lot of people who want to go do more of that. So what would you tell them?
Boy, I tell you what, I think cover adjacent to food for bobwhites is probably the most critical key to finding birds.
Yeah.
And then I think if you're hunting with dogs, obviously I like to just follow the dog.
Yeah.
I don't want to say, well, I'm going to walk down this edge
and
hopefully I'll bump a covey along this edge. I let the dogs out, and wherever the dog goes, that's where I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And the bobwhites may be down in the bottom of the creek. where the brush is heavy and the ground is wet, or they might be right up on the edge because they need to go get another bite to eat or something.
Yeah.
But I'm going to follow my dogs and believe in my dogs, and they're the ones that are going to find me. And then when they do find a covey, my best advice to anybody hunting bobwhites or any kind of quail is pick one bird. Pick one bird, or you're just shooting holes
in
the sky.
And pick it fast, right?
Yeah, and pick it quickly.
Oh. I better write that down. I thought it was pick one hole.
Yeah, I've done that plenty of times. Yeah, it's funny where there'll be six shots ring out and not a bird falling. You look around at your two buddies on either side of you, and we all just kind of hands up going, I don't know what happened there.
But. Or worse, you all shoot and one bird falls and you all think you hit it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's happened many times before as well.
That's why I run out and do the retrieve myself.
Yeah.
But you mentioned, and see, as a local boy, we're going to pick your brain for all the good stuff. Cover next to food.
Yeah, critical.
What are both? I mean, are we talking plum thickets?
Yes.
And corn?
Yes.
And wheat?
Yes.
And what about wild foods? What are the quail going to eat in Kansas?
You open up a crop, you're going to find just about anything in there. That might be different kinds of wildflower seeds, all kinds of weed seeds.
Yeah.
You know, milo, of course, and wheat and corn. Any of that stuff. I mean, absent a good crop like we had this year, we had a tough year of crop. So absent, you know, good heads of milo on the ground, a lot of corn on the ground. You know, they were surviving on a lot of the weeds.
Yeah.
And I mean, the coveys weren't as big, I don't think, but the birds that did survive are strong birds, and they're going to be great for the birds to come in the next season. So, I mean, they're tough little critters. They've got a strong will to live. I mean, like I said, food adjacent to cover, and if there's water, any kind of water, any splash of water around, that's critical for them too. So if you can identify as a hunter, if you were going out for the first time and you were hoping to find some bobwhites, I would say those three components. You get a little splash of water if you've got it out there. You got decent cover, and it might just be wide fence lines.
Yeah.
And they'll be there if you've got, I mean, you've got food on either side. They could just, all you need are fence lines that are good. And if you get a little water at the end of the road, that's pretty good too. So
great. That's Tom Dombrowski. I'm Scott Linden. That's Trevor Waltz to your left or right, depending on where your stereo is adjusted. We're talking from the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Trevor, help me with this. You mentioned water, Tom, and in the West, of course, we know that certain birds, they do go to water every day. I had an old-timer once said, how's your season going? I said, it's pretty hot today, blah, blah. He says, well, if you go to that creek at 1 o'clock, the chuckers will be walking down the hill to that creek that I'm not going to name on the podcast. And we were desperate, so we did. We parked, we crept, we snuck, and son of a gun if there wasn't a little line. And they were each taking the number, hopping down over the little lip and getting a drink and then waddling all the way back up. Do you see that, Trevor, with any other of the Western game birds? Have you seen that with Sharpies or Huns or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, yes, water is absolutely critical to their survival, but you know, most of those birds are getting it from the morning.
Yeah.
Or they're getting it in the morning from grasses and which doesn't mean they don't pay attention to water tanks and things like that, but I would say pay more attention to them as it starts to dry out later in the day, or if it's a time of drought, you know, of low moisture. But yeah, for the most part, they're getting what they need early in the day from kind of natural habitat.
Yeah.
There's always circumstances that, you know, you pay attention to standing water, but I'd say generally speaking, not quite the same as a chucker or a quail.
It's been a phenomenon in much of the West for the last 4 or 5 years, and that is this, I want to say, this eruption of Hungarian partridge.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often in my country, it's in what I call chucker light country, and I spell LITE, you know, just like every other fashionable trend.
Sure.
why don't you clue us in, because you're in Hun country too. What are some of the tried and true strategies you use for Huns as opposed to the others? Nobody's really talking about that stuff yet. And I think it's I think it's more than a fad. I think we're going to see more and more Huns. So give us a clue.
Where to find them?
Yeah, find them, chase them. Yeah, strategy. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, you're looking for ground that's got more elevation, a little bit more bare than, you know, where I'd typically find a sharp tail, you know, so less grasslands. Not to say that, again, I mean, anything's an option.
Yeah.
But, you know, generally they're, you know, a little bit rockier terrain, not to the extent of a chucker. But more hillsides. You know, you've got to remember these are small birds, especially compared to a sharp tail. So their first strategy is to get up and get gone. They're not going to run away from you. Their eyes are always out, and they're looking for elevated pitches that they can get up, get some wind lift, and get away.
I'll be darned. I'd never thought about it as an aerodynamic challenge. That makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it?
Sure. And I mean, we, you know, as we saw in September, I mean, yeah, you're going to find them usually in, you know, close to crops and, you know, grains and things of that nature. So yeah, can you find them out in a cut field? Absolutely. And you should look there. But, you know, where I am in the part of the state, I tend to spend more time in elevation and a little bit rockier terrain.
You know, after you guys went wherever you were going next, somewhere else far away, I stayed another day and I walked around closer to the home place, where all the big round bales were. And I found birds hiding amongst the round bales.
Sure.
What the heck? What was that all about? Is the shade, maybe? Or just that was cover?
Yeah, cover.
In its own way.
Cover, and there's a food source there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're kind of able to eat and feel like they're not going to get swept from above. You know, and especially these young falcons, you know, birds of prey are always looking for an easy meal. A hun is a lot easier to pick off, at least from a size standpoint, than a sharp tail is.
Yep.
That's another thing to keep in mind, especially, you know, as the size of the bird diminishes or, you know, decreases, they're looking out for themselves all the time.
And there is, you know, if you look at a round bale, there's a little edge on both bottoms where there is basically overhead cover.
Sure.
It's a long, skinny spot, but it's better than nothing. By the way, Tom, did you know that those round bales will soon be outlawed in Kansas?
I did not know that.
Yeah. The cows can't get a square meal.
Oh, my goodness.
Note to editor, insert rim shot.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Ba-dum-bum. There you go.
Let's get more practical, more relevant. Tom, when you're out there in Kansas or anywhere else, in your vest are all the usual suspects: ammo, water, probably a leash. But is there anything in there that you carry that maybe most of us don't, that we ought to? What's helped you in a fix or just become a better hunter?
Oh boy, that's a great question. I would say, well, and this is more specific to one of my dogs that has some blood sugar issues that I've identified over the years. I carry a tube of frosting in my pocket.
I love
him.
It. Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I give him a big squirt before we hit the field.
Really?
And then about halfway through, I'll give him another big squirt. And,
wow.
And that sustains him throughout that hunt. And I don't have to carry him out of the field, which I have had to do a couple of times.
Been there, done that with other people's dogs, knock wood.
Yeah.
For the record, not chocolate frosting.
No, it's just a vanilla.
But I love that because it's basically white. It's sugar.
Yeah.
It's
absolutely
toothpaste consistency sugar, isn't it?
Absolutely. When I take my dogs out, and it's overnight and so forth, that they're reluctant sometimes to eat the same way they do at home.
Yep.
So the volume of food that they have to sustain them is diminished. And when they get out and they start running big like they like to do, they burn up that stuff pretty quick. Yeah. So I'm always looking for more protein sources in the little bit of food that I know they will eat too. Yeah. So I get the highest protein that I can in the food, and I'll throw some non-processed stuff in there too. Yeah. So I don't want any sodium or anything like that, but some beef in there for them to get a little bit more of that. And hopefully that'll sustain them a little bit longer.
The other thing I found, same way, because I don't feed in the morning on hunt days.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I get a product, I've had several over the years. The ones I like, one is called Gainer, and the other one is called Super Weight, I think, W-A-T-E. If you Google all that, you'll find it real fast. They're both powders, and they're basically powdered fat.
Mm-hmm.
Sprinkle that on. Number one, the dogs love it, so they'll eat that food, because you might have that problem too. And that fat will bring them a little bit more energy. So try that if you ever need another fix.
It's good to know.
Yeah. How about you, Trevor? You're out there, and you have been a guide. You hunt a lot. What's in your vest?
Probably a lot of the things that people carry, but then, you know, from a maybe a non-traditional for some of your audience is bear spray. And we're seeing it more and more. You look way back when to the Lewis and Clark days, and you know, grizzly bears lived in the plains, and they're coming back to the plains, so we're seeing them farther east. So that's something we're mindful of, and No surprise to probably many, they don't like dogs a whole lot. So
no.
Usually that kind of heightens the opportunity for an interaction. But, knock on wood, I'm not seeing any around here. But haven't had any yet. But, it'll happen. And so, bear spray is something that's always in the truck. And depending on the region, in the vest.
Have you ever actually seen one while hunting?
I haven't seen any grizz. I've seen plenty of signs of it.
Yeah.
Very fresh. Definitely they've been in the area. Seen a lot of black bears. And again, that species is starting to move into different areas as well.
Yeah.
So, no, not yet. But, know a lot of people that have, have seen them. And like I said, it's going to happen more and more.
Yeah, it is, and it is worth looking at. Whenever I fish Canada, mm-hmm. I've always got one in my vest. And then until you reminded me that I should bring some along on our last hunt, I'd never, ever have conceived of it. But if you know your history, like you said, they were all over the place. So were the elk.
Yep.
Not seeing those either, are you?
Here and there.
Well, if each of you were to provide one bit of advice about bird hunting, gear, getting in shape, it doesn't matter. You get first crack at it, Tom, so Trevor, you can think about it for a moment. What would you tell people that would help them have a better bird hunting experience?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that I could tell them would be to enjoy everything that's happening around you, and don't sweat out whether or not you're harvesting birds.
Yeah.
Learn to appreciate the little things, the little nuances, the little things that your dogs do as they hit the field. Learn to appreciate the respect that the young dog learns to have for the older dog. And learn about watching the dogs do their thing. And really, really, I mean, that's why I hunt anymore.
Yeah.
I've been hunting since I was 10 years old. And I tell you what, the most fun that I have every time I'm out is just watching those dogs do their thing. So,
amen.
Don't sweat the limits. Don't count the birds.
Yeah.
Just have fun and enjoy the time that you're out there with your friends and with your pups.
As Jose Ortega y Gasset said, it's not the killing, it's the prospect of killing that makes it a hunt.
Yes.
And especially when you shoot like I do. How about you, Trevor? Where's your wisdom for today?
I mean, I agree with everything that Tom said. If I'm going to add to that, it's go hunting.
Yeah.
You can never beat that experience. And if the dogs matter to you, which they do to all of us, there's no better experience for them and for you than actually hunting. And I mean, I'm not putting down yard work, and there's a lot of things that we all need to do to help increase the opportunities and the success and create better experiences. But at the end of the day, if you've got an opportunity to go hunting, go.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't said it better, even if I tried, and I'm not even going to try. From the floor of the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, I'm Scott Linden. Trevor Waltz, Tom Dombrowski from LandTrust.com. Go visit them over there and see what it's all about. It's so simple, even I can do it. Probably even a caveman could do it. Da-dum-dum. I'll probably get sued for that, but that's for later. Thanks so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast, guys.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
Appreciate it.
Boy, that was fun, and looking forward to Kansas City and Pheasant Fest and the Quail Classic next year already. Stick around. We will start talking about starting to train dogs with dead birds in just a moment right after this word from LandTrust.com. Yeah, I've been, I mentioned I'm working on a big, long road trip and doing my research at LandTrust.com to kind of plot an itinerary and make sure that when I go, I have somewhere good to go that's been vetted, checked out, scouted by somebody who knows their stuff. Maybe it's Tom, maybe it's Trevor, but those guys, that's what they do at LandTrust.com. It's similar to an Airbnb, for example. It connects, LandTrust.com connects trusted guests with landowners so you can have exclusive access to their land. You and your dog and a friend and his dog. Yeah. It's the way to assure that your experience hunting with your dog and your friends is as stress-free as it can be. Check them out at LandTrust.com. Shop around, see if there's any place there that might be worth looking at. And clean your gun after every trip, every hunt if you can. SageandBreaker.com is where you get your gun cleaning and care products. Everything from, the spray-on CLP or the firearms grease, which is back in stock. Sign up for the mailing list and you won't miss out on any future sales or when things come back in stock after they've sold out. Gotta wonder why. Hey. Yeah, learn more at SageandBreaker.com. And speaking of learning, Just started work on a new educational video for highvizsites.com. Yeah, they've got a great learning page. You start at shooting tips and pick up some of those bits of advice that they have there at highvizsites.com, H-I-V-I-Z sites.com. They offer magnetic screw attach and plain barrel sights to fit just about every shotgun on the market. There's a reason they're installed as original equipment on most major brands, Ruger, Benelli, Browning, Remington. Yeah, their light pipe system allows you to change the color of your light pipe to fit the environment and lighting conditions and help you work on that bead, muzzle, target relationship. Learn more at highvizsites.com. Well, no birds, no bird dog. George Hickok said it best. In this week in the Handle It segment, I'm going to talk about one of the tools that you will be using as you bring your young or your experienced dog along. Yeah, they're called bird dogs for a reason, and so for that reason, you might want to start assembling a collection of birds. Well, I know most people can't keep a pigeon coop, but if you can, all the better, even if it's a small one, because dead birds are only half the package. The other half are the live ones. But right now, for so many reasons, a dead bird in a dog's mouth is an important part of training. Even pieces of dead birds. So when you go to a training day or you have a friend who says, yeah, we just went out and did this and this, start asking about dead birds. Can I have some? make a space in the freezer for those dead birds and dead bird wings and feathers and that sort of thing. Best way to store them, thank you, Evan, for this bit of advice, is not in a plastic bag, but it's in a paper bag. Don't worry about odor. There's no such thing in a freezer. Paper bag allows all the moisture to vent out and keeps that bird dry. And if you use a lot of dead birds, you'll know what I mean. They get awful sloppy sometimes. You know, you use your parts for everything from introducing a pup to bird smell to introducing gunfire, and then, of course, for retrieving and all the steadiness aspects that come between those two pieces. Yeah, a bird in the mouth is the ultimate reward for your dog, so start collecting those birds now. Hey, if you haven't yet, go to the Facebook page or the Instagram page or the Twitter, whatever they call it, feed, and ask your training and dog care questions. I'll be starting to answer those next week, every other week on the podcast. And the Handle It segment this week is brought to you by ESPAmerica.com. Yeah, in addition to carefully training your dog, you want to carefully protect your hearing in the field as well as the range. I've been using mine a lot at the range lately, my ESP hearing protection devices. They're custom fit, which is a simple process. Anybody in town can probably do it for you. And that's the best reason they are so effective. They basically seal your ear from the gunfire. They also let in the right amount of sounds at the right level, thanks to the carefully placed microphone location, which also minimizes wind noise. Hey, take a look at their website, ESPAmerica.com. They'll probably explain it a lot better than I can, but listen, it works. I'm using them. And remember, hearing loss is permanent and cumulative. With every shot that's unprotected, you're going deaf. But shoot a lot anyway. Take a lesson at MidValleyClays.com. Yeah, they've got some great instructors, great target shooters who are also hunters. In addition to MidValleyClays.com's shooting school, they also have a line on all the most desirable shotguns and even some of the hard-to-find stuff. Dave Fiedler knows guns and hunting and has a special relationship with a lot of the manufacturers. So if you can't find it somewhere else, or you're just starting your search and you're looking for somebody to counsel with about, well, whether it's an over and under versus a side-by-side, what gauge, what size, what materials, Dave knows that stuff inside and out, and he's glad to help you. Go to MidValleyClays.com, get the phone number, call Dave Fiedler, talk shotguns. Hey, who doesn't want to do that? And don't forget, he'll ship any gun, anywhere, anytime. MidValleyClays.com. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your listening. All of you have commented on the social platforms and helped everybody else learn a little bit more. Sure am grateful for that. And I'm grateful, of course, to our sponsors who make this all possible. Hi-Vis Shooting Systems, LandTrust.com, MidwayUSA.com, TruLock Chokes, Mid Valley Clays, ESP America, Pro Plan Sport from Purina, Pointer Shotguns, and Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products. Thank you, Tom Dombrowski and Trevor Waltz from LandTrust.com. Learned something from you as well, always do. And especially thank you, listeners, for sticking with us. Yes, indeed, I am so grateful to you for your support. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.